If you're looking at your phone right now, you've found us on mobile, which means we can get a move on. You know me, you know what this is, so let's begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in today for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show them what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
The sound there of protesters rallying at North Charleston Hall in South Carolina today following the death of an African-American man, Walter Scott, who was apparently unarmed and running away from Officer Michael Slager, who was white, when Slager shot and killed him. The circumstances of Scott's death might never have surfaced were it not for the video captured by a bystander and sent to the New York Times. In response, Officer Slager was charged with murder on Tuesday. Here's North Charleston Mayor Keith Summey at a press conference late last night.
I can tell you that as the result of that video and the bad decision made by our officer, he will be charged with murder.
That footage unravels Officer Slager's story that the shooting occurred after he and Mr. Scott struggled over the officer's taser in a scuffle over a traffic stop.
It would have never come to life. They would have swept it under the rug like they've done many others.
That's Walter Scott's father, also Walter, speaking on NBC's Today Show earlier today. So there may be a swifter path to justice here than in the other recent cases of African Americans dying at the hands of the police. Joining me now with more is Michael Schmidt, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. The Times received the video that drastically shifted this case on Tuesday. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And the video came to you from the lawyers for Walter Scott's family, correct?
Correct.
And they sent that on Tuesday, and it was the Times that posted it that, as I said, drastically shifted this case.
Correct. I think that I don't know what the police department knew, but it was pretty clear that they knew something around the time that we got the video. And I think that the video put an enormous amount of pressure on them to do something. If you looked at the media reports out of North Charleston in the days after the shooting, they painted a far different picture. But what happened was when they saw this video, it sort of turned that upside down and really raised a lot of questions about it. I've never seen a local police department move so quickly on a police-involved shooting.
Right, and let's stress the shift in the narrative here that the video brought about, because Officer Slager's original statement after the incident was that the suspect fought for his taser and used that familiar phrase that we've heard in so many other cases, that he feared for his life.
Yeah, the thing is, there may have been a struggle for the taser because that isn't shown on the video. All that's shown on the video is the two of them sort of breaking away, the taser going flying in one direction, sort of to the left of the officer, and to the right of the officer is Mr. Scott running away. At that point, Mr. Scott doesn't appear to have anything in his hands. He's running away, and the officer takes out his gun, and as he's running, he shoots him. I think that the problem with the narrative at that point is that was the officer really – did he really feel in danger that he had Mr. Scott running away from him without a weapon in his hands?
And the thing that's important in cases like this is not what the suspect was suspected of having done to initiate the stop or whether they fought before. It's at the moment that the trigger is pulled whether the officer has a reasonable reason to fear for his life. And in this case, if the suspect is running away at 20 or 30 yards, that's hard to imagine.
Well, the other question here is whether whether Mr. Scott may have posed a danger to anyone else, because officers can use the lethal force if they believe that a suspect could harm others. It doesn't appear like anyone was around in the sort of near vicinity at the time, but we can only really see what the video shows. So maybe that will be an argument that the officer uses.
There's a second part to this video also, which may go beyond charges of murder, which is the officer then cuffs the suspect after the shots are fired, goes back and picks up what appears to be the taser and drops it next to the body.
He picks something up from that went appears to have gone flying during the scuffle, and he moves it and he drops it next to the body. He does, and then he later goes back and picks it up and when another officer is nearby and then puts it on his belt. we don't know exactly what it was, but what it does show is that he was moving things around at the crime scene in less in minutes, or if not seconds, after the incident.
And what's your assessment, Michael Schmidt, of the community reaction around this case? It's tragic, but it has taken a different turn than so many others.
By moving so quickly, they have, the local authorities and the mayor have really taken, I think they've de-escalated the issue, and they have ratcheted it down in a way that we haven't seen in other incidents. Even before we could get the video out there yesterday, and we were moving as fast as we could to do that, they announced that they had brought that they were going to bring murder charges. So by the time that the video was out there, the locals already said they had an answer to it, which was, we've made an arrest.
Well, it's clear that the case of the shooting, the death of Walter Scott, has taken a very different turn than other apparently similar cases that the country has seen over the last months and years. It's happened in North Charleston in South Carolina. The New York Times posted the critical witness video that has turned this case. Michael Schmidt, reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
On to Kansas now, where this week the state became the first in the nation to outlaw a particular abortion procedure in the second trimester. Kansas is known for its staunch pro-life stance, and so is the state's Governor Sam Brownback. Last January, on the 42nd anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision at the Supreme Court, Brownback headlined a Kansas Right to Life event at the State House in Topeka this way.
Let us see an end to the killing of children in Kansas.
According to the Guttmacher Institute, a pro-choice think tank, Kansas has only 3 abortion providers left in the state. And bills similar to the one that Kansas has passed have also been introduced in places like Missouri and Oklahoma and back in South Carolina. These are the latest examples in a growing trend of state laws restricting access to abortion in sort of a mosaic fashion. Elizabeth Nash is Senior State Issues Associate for the Guttmacher Institute, and she joins me now with more. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
First, let's deal with Kansas. Can you help us understand exactly what the Kansas law does? Because so many of the state laws that are popping up and being proposed, some of them take less than direct routes to restricting abortion.
I'd say this law is also a little bit of a mystery. Clearly, the bill is aimed at making second trimester abortion difficult to access in the state. But exactly what is banned is still being sussed out by the providers, because the language used in the bill is not medical language and doesn't mention a specific method of abortion. So as a result, providers are really left with trying to figure out exactly what they're allowed to do and what they're not.
If a bill like this is vague in terms of its medical language, does that make it vulnerable in front of the Supreme Court? And I ask that because a ban on partial birth abortion in the state of Nebraska back in 2000 was overturned by the Supreme Court, largely because the medical language of partial birth abortion was deemed too vague.
Exactly. So we're in a very similar situation here in Kansas, where it's unclear exactly as to what is being banned and what is being allowed. And, you know, note that at the end of the day in 2007, the Supreme Court upheld the federal version of the partial birth abortion ban. So that law is in effect across the country because it was enacted by Congress and upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. So we are seeing sometimes this language become law and go into effect. And now we just have to see what's going to happen in Kansas. Certainly people there are looking at litigation.
Now, these Supreme Court rulings, you mentioned one in 2007 that upheld the federal ban on partial birth abortion. I mentioned one that overturned Nebraska in the year 2000. And these Supreme Court rulings seem to sort of provide the guidance or even the starting gun for states to take their own routes in trying to restrict abortion. For instance, Texas has taken a route where they're not really restricting abortion. They're restricting clinics and making it hard for clinics to stay open, and many have closed. So what are some of the states doing to restrict abortion in ways that don't actually tell a woman you can't have one or tell a doctor you can't perform one?
So we're seeing lots of variations on this theme. Certainly we're seeing laws that require a woman to wait a specific time before she can have the abortion, sometimes 72 hours. We're seeing laws that require women to get misleading and inaccurate information about abortion, such as that you could get breast cancer from having an abortion. That's been disproven by scientists in the National Cancer Institute. We're seeing people making it harder for women to pay for abortion by limiting their health plans and what the health plan can cover. So we're seeing those kinds of restrictions that affect women directly. Then we're seeing restrictions that focus on providers by saying that they can have clinics, but the clinic room sizes have to be a certain width and length, and the hallways have to be a certain width and length. And those sorts of requirements, although may seem tedious and benign to some, make it very difficult to keep your clinic doors open. Also, we're seeing attacks on providers by requiring admitting privileges at local hospitals, which can be very difficult to get, especially because hospitals tend to shy away from controversial issues such as abortion. Between 2011 and 2014, we saw 231 abortion restrictions enacted in 30 states. So it really isn't just Texas or Kansas, the two states we've been talking about today. It's all across the country.
Now, pro-life opposition to abortion is nothing new at all. So what's led to what seems to be this latest strategy and the latest push for so many smaller restrictions piling up in so many states that are taking action against abortion from so many different directions? What's behind it?
For a long time now, for a couple of decades, we've really seen state legislatures adopt abortion restrictions. But we saw this huge increase in 2011, and that was a direct result of the elections in 2010. In 2010, we saw a number of state legislatures and governorships move dramatically to the conservative end. And as a result, they started adopting abortion restrictions incredibly quickly. They just have piled up so fast. You know, we really have seen, no action at the congressional level, although there have been some small expansions of abortion access actually last year around the Peace Corps. But, if you're talking about abortion restrictions, you have to look to the states. And it's a real shame because the states could also be used to make sure that young people have access to good sex education and that all individuals have access to contraceptive services.
Elizabeth Nash, Senior State Issues Associate for the Guttmacher Institute, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Last month, American astronaut Scott Kelly was launched into space along with Russia's Mikhail Kornienko, and together they're going to spend 1 year on the International Space Station, completing the longest expedition on that station ever. But that mission isn't just about what will happen in space. It's also about how that will compare to what's happening right here on the Earth. And that's because Scott Kelly has an identical twin brother named Mark, who's also an American astronaut, and whose body will be the basis for comparison studies between the twins throughout next year. Mark Kelly joins us now from member station KUAZ in Tucson, Arizona. Captain Kelly, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be on your show.
And it's great to have you. Americans know you from your shuttle missions. They know you from your well-known wife, former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. And they're going to know you from experimentation going on with NASA right now.
Yeah, as a NASA guinea pig.
Now, it's all about a twin study. Look, twin studies are familiar to lots of different kinds of science. And the idea is that you and your brother are identical genetically. So by studying you two together, they can study the effects of weightlessness and space travel on lots of different things, I take it.
Yeah, that's the idea. When Scott was assigned to this one-year mission, this science that they were going to do on us hadn't been it hadn't even been proposed. But after, he started his training, he asked some questions. And then NASA really started to think about this, and they realized they have a unique opportunity to do a lot of research on the genetic effects of being in that space environment, which is a pretty hazardous and unforgiving environment.
So to make the experiments elegant and informative, I guess you and Scott have to do similar things, but he's in a weightless environment and you're not. So what's going to happen? Are you going to do the same exercise, eat the same foods?
Not exactly. I mean, that would be, he's in a very controlled environment and I'm not. So for me to commit to eating the same packaged, freeze-dried, rehydratable stuff for a year.
Yeah, you're not going
to
do that.
No, I wasn't signing up to do that. But, there's a lot of we're so much similar in so many ways. And the big difference is going to be when he gets back from this mission, he will have spent over 500 days in space. And I will have spent about 54. Actually, if he lands on the day he's supposed to land right now, it's to the day 10 times the amount. So, I mean, that, you know, they should be able to learn a lot about us in a lot of different ways.
So that means that most of the assessment, the experimentation that goes on will go on after he lands, comparing you two. You're not doing sort of a priori manipulations while he's in space and you're on the Earth.
No, we have, even before he launched. I mean, I made a couple trips to NASA. They sent people out to get samples. I mean, once in New York City, somebody came by my hotel to get 20 tubes of blood. And, you know, there's been a lot done already, and I'll continue to do that during his mission to get more data. And then after he comes back, and then who knows how long this will last. I mean, I see a scenario where they're going to want to look at the difference between us, not only right after the flight, but 10 or 20 years down the road.
And what do the biologists and physiologists who you've talked to posit as their working theories as to what the differences might be, the effects of 500 days of weightlessness on your brother that you won't experience?
Well, so I'm not a scientist, and all these experiments are different, and some of them have some pretty interesting, you know, names, like, you know, I could read you one here. This isn't off the top of my head, but the comprehensive whole genome analysis of differential epigenetic effects of space travel on monozygotic twins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a Johns Hopkins study, or another one that's looking at the length of telomeres. So it's, you know, some pretty hard biological science. There's also cognitive research they're doing. You know, almost everybody, once they get into space, they feel like they've been, you know, you get a little dumber. I mean, it's really – sometimes it's hard to focus. You're sleep deprived. But there seems to be something else going on. So there is some cognitive tests, you know, that we're going to be doing as well. And then the human biome, you know, I've read that, you know, there are more cells inside of us in our gut than there are cells of actually the human body. And, you know, that seems to change in space. So, you know, there's a lot of – I think there's about 10, maybe a dozen different research studies.
You know, being on board a space station for so long, you could theorize that it's just the monotony of the work. It's being in an enclosed, kind of unstimulating environment. Who knows if the air is exactly the same? I could come up with theories. They're trying to get to the bottom of this.
Well, let me tell you one of the big issues. I mean, the biggest issue in my mind is the radiation. You know, how does that radiation environment affect the human body? When you're in orbit around the Earth above the atmosphere and you do not have the protection of our atmosphere, you get a serious dose of radiation. It's so much that you close your eyes at night and you can see the gamma radiation flying through your retina. You see it in what looks like, if it's dark and you have your eyes closed, little like thunderstorms inside your eyes.
Huh.
So, you know, it's not only flying through your retinas, you know, it's flying through the rest of you. So that radiation has an impact, and we need to learn what that is. You know, for I guess for some people it's pretty obvious, but for others maybe not, so we'll explain it. You know, if we ever want to send somebody to the planet Mars, that's going to be a trip that might be, you know, 2 to 2.5 years, maybe 3 years in length. And we don't know if the human body can handle that. So we have to learn not only, you know, the question is can it handle it, but if we can't, you know, what do we do to mitigate for these effects? You know, and there are a lot of things we've been able to overcome with space travel, and we might have to be able to figure out ways to overcome, you know, the radiation and the zero gravity environment and the depression of your immune system and the bone loss and muscle loss, those kind of things.
I was going to say, if they want to get to the bottom of gamma radiation sickness and hair loss, they might be barking up the wrong tree, Captain.
That's right. Yeah, that wouldn't be – they'd have to find two other twins that have a better head of hair.
Now, I read this, and you'll tell me if it's true because you know more than I do, but relativity says that when Scott gets back, he's going to be a couple of 8 or 10 milliseconds younger than you, right?
Yeah, I guess, right? So let's think about this. So Einstein figured this out, that with speed, time slows down.
Right.
So if you could go, you know, at the speed of light for a long period of time, you might come back to Earth, and it might feel 10 years for you. And maybe 12 years have passed on Earth. So that's kind of the case. I guess he wouldn't catch up, right? He would get further behind. But the bottom line is, yeah, I mean, you know, we're going to age at different rates, but it's really, really small at that speed.
Captain Mark Kelly is an astronaut, as is his twin brother Scott. Together, they're the subjects of multiple twin-based research studies on the effects of long-term spaceflight on the human body. Mark is also the author of the new children's book about space-traveling brothers called Astro Twins.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo, offering a variety of business cards and printed products. Moo also offers Printfinity, the ability to print a different image on every card. More at Moo.com. And Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
They were singing, bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die.
One of America's greatest cultural anthems, American Pie, by singer-songwriter Don McLean in 1971. But just who is the jester? Who broke the church bells? And what really happened the day the music died? Well, some of those codes might now be cracked, as the 8.5 minutes worth of lyrics plus other notes that never made it into the song have been sold to an anonymous bidder for $1.2 million by Christie's. Now, McLean has stated the writing and the lyrics will divulge everything there is to divulge. Well, we wanted to do a little decoding of our own, and to help us with that is John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our co-producer WNYC, and he joins me in the studio. Hi, John.
Hey, Todd.
Well, how much do you think we know for sure about the cryptology of American Pie?
I think Don McLean, as we know from this song, chooses his words carefully, and the way he said, whatever there is to divulge will be divulged, basically says, you know, it's there. These are just notes, you know. You're not going to find – there's no Enigma machine, you know, decoding what I've done here. It's a song.
And I think Don McLean knew in the run-up to this auction that goes to the highest bidder that ginning up the mystery about what the song is about helps to drive the price up.
He has seen Carly Simon make a career out of not telling us who the you in You're So Vain is.
Right.
You know, to the point where she actually re-recorded the song a few years back with a whispered name hidden backwards in the song. Which turned out to be the name David. And she claimed it wasn't Geffen, so we're back to square one anyway. So this kind of game, if it's offered to you, it pays to play.
And these two artists, Carly Simon and Don McLean, are not the only two who know how to play this game. We're going to get to a lot of examples that both I and our listeners and you have of other songs that just have dogged us. We can't figure them out. But you have brought along a couple of your own cryptology examples from American Pie.
Well, I think it's generally agreed that the day the music died, which is often referred to the day that the plane went down,
Buddy Holly
and the Big Bopper, and that is what Don McLean is alluding to early in the song, where he talks about delivering the newspaper. You know, with every paper I delivered, bad news on the doorstep.
I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride, but something touched me deep inside the day the music died.
And that's probably maybe the most obvious part of the song.
I think that is the clearest kind of bit of cryptology that we can do on this song. The rest of it,
let's delve.
It's a kind of interesting jumble of religious imagery and kind of allusions to other rock songs. 8 Miles High from the Byrds is sort of alluded to in passing. Jumping Jack Flash by the Rolling Stones alluded to only in passing. And there's a kind of sense of almost apocalypse in some of the lyrics.
And while Lennon read a book on Marx, the quartet practiced in the park, and we sang dirges in the dark. The day the music died.
I always thought that this was some kind of an allusion to World War II in the Yalta talks. I didn't know what to think about this.
Yeah, but, you know, the broken church bells, dirges in the dark, you know, something has happened. And, you know, if this were an English songwriter, then maybe we would say, all right, he's remembering a childhood in London during the Blitz or whatever.
Yeah.
But this is an American, you know, he didn't live through that. So what he did live through was the kind of promise of the 50s, of the Pax Americana, and then the disillusion of the 60s. And remember, he's writing this at the end of the 60s, early 70s, and it's a time of incredible turmoil, and that really is kind of the overall theme, the overall gestalt, if you will, of this song. It's almost as if he's trying to make sense of, you know, the change in music, the change in the culture, with those allusions to the Birds and the Rolling Stones. Do you take those as being, this is part of the problem, or do you take those references as meaning these guys are documenting what I'm talking about in the culture? It could go either way.
And that's part of the beauty of the song. Okay, $1.2 million, as I said. This has caused lots of fascination and fueled a lot of the cryptology of American Pie. But we asked you, the listener, for the songs that might have a meaning that just dogs you, that you just can't figure out. And boy, did you respond.
This is Gaspar Forteza from Miami. My submission is Yellow Ledbetter by Pearl Jam. That wonderful, wonderful song is either about a letter and long-lost love or waving potatoes and making French fries. One or the other. Great song.
On a year, on a wizard, on a way, yeah.
John Schaefer, if only we could ask Eddie Vedder whether this was about lost love or French fries. Possibly both.
I don't know how anybody knows what he's singing anyway. Well, I mean, now you can Google all the lyrics and stuff. I will say this. Ledbetter is the real last name of the great bluesman Leadbelly. His name was Huddy Ledbetter. So I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that is intentional. Whether it has anything to do with the lyrics, I mean, you know, you can parse Eddie Vedder's lyrics from now until the cows come home. He's one of those songwriters who traffics in ambiguity, and that allows the listener in.
Sure.
So for all of us who think we know what American Pie means, we do. It may not be what Don McLean meant, but if it's what it means to us, that is just as authentic and viable an interpretation as whatever cryptic notes he's written on the side of the lyrics that were just auctioned off.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to this one. We have another listener who's gone to Minnesota. We have a listener from Portland who says, Seven by Prince, it's a very Book of Revelation-ish song, but I've never been clear on the meaning.
Absolutely. This, again, is very apocalyptic imagery. Seven sins. I mean, seven is an important number. All of Prince's songs were about sex somehow, but definitely the apocalyptic imagery in this song for sure.
All right. Well, my favorite artist, one of my favorite artists of all time, here's Host Prerogative, trafficked in cryptology all the time and drew me in because I didn't know what he was talking about half the time. Listen to this one from my man.
It's on America's tortured brow that Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame.
That's David Bowie, and that's Life on Mars. Help.
Well, you know, in the 70s, David Bowie had this kind of fascination with fascism. So you can't tell from the way he's singing, but it's America with a K.
With a K.
He references, you know, Himmler and Churchill. And, you know, so there's, as opposed to looking forward to the apocalypse, he's looking back at an apocalypse that had recently, you know, happened in Europe. Then, of course, it's a song about
Fighting in the dance hall, yeah, and beating up the wrong guy.
Right. It's a kind of, you know, celluloid heroes kind of thing.
And absolutely all over the place. And that's why we love you so much, David. And John Schaefer, that's why we love you, for helping us figure out all these songs. John Schaefer is host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station, WNYC. If you want to hear anything back that you've heard on the show, including cryptographical lyrics, go on our website at thetakeaway.org. You can always tweet us at thetakeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
Who's done the best-selling show? Is there life on Mars?
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at gotomeeting.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.